Dear friends, the topic of today's short talk is the source of evil in human life. In the ancient traditions and mythologies, good and evil was always shown to be arising from the same source. We all know about the Suras and the Asuras. Both are born from the same parent. In the Zoroastrian system, there is Ormuzd and Ahriman. And probably last Sunday or so, we heard of the beautiful allegory of how both Ormuzd and Ahriman, the twins, one representing good, another representing evil, are born from the same womb of Zeruana. So, common source. In the Chinese system, there is the yin and yang. Right? The basic idea is that yin and yang are not opposites, but actually complemented. If you recollect the symbol of yin and yang, there is the black part representing yin, the feminine principle, the negative principle, but there is a white dot in it. On the other hand, there is a white section, white half of the circle representing the yang, but there is a black dot in it. Something that we have to contemplate on, how evil actually gives rise to good. What we call as evil actually gives rise to good. And what is it, the black dot in the white section, is something that we have to think about. So these are both aspects of one. This is the first thing that we have to understand. There are no separate good and evil as independent entities, but are aspects of one. And if we say that God is omniscient, omnipresent, is omniscient, omnipresent, then that deity has to contain evil also. Otherwise, that deity would not be omnipresent, all-encompassing, whole. The moment you say whole, it means that everything that is there is part of that. Marcus Aurelius, the Greek philosopher, the Roman king, had a very interesting perspective about good and evil. Specifically about evil. What does he say specifically about evil? How does he see evil in other men? Very interesting. His contemplation, his reflections were he recorded them. And one small paragraph speaks of this. He says, I quote, "A bitter cucumber, throw it away. Brambles in the path, go round them. You need, without going on to ask, so why are these things in the world anyway?" That question would be laughable to a student of nature, just as any carpenter or cobbler would laugh at you if you objected to the sight of shavings or offcuts from their work on the shop floor. Yet they have somewhere to throw their rubbish, whereas the nature of the whole has nothing outside itself. The marvel of its craft is that it sets its own confines, recycles into itself all within them, which seems to be decaying, growing old, or losing its use, and then creates afresh from this same material. This way, it requires no substance other than its own and has no need for a rubbish dump. So it is complete in its own space, material, and its own craftsmanship. So the idea is clear, right? If you go to a carpenter shop and then laugh at, oh, there is all these shavings, dirty and all that, He will say, it's a part of the work. If you want to create something beautiful, all this is part of the work. A carpenter's situation is different. He can take all this and throw it somewhere. But can what about the whole? Whole with the capital W, the DT. Everything is that. So it recycles. Out of the bad, it creates good. How it happens, we will see that in the course of the talk. So, these contrasts are absolutely necessary. Without centripetal force, centrifugal couldn't exist. And without the centrifugal, centripetal wouldn't exist. You take the one out of the equation, the universe collapses. You take only day without night. By the second or third day, all life will perish due to the excess of sunlight. Night is needed. Darkness is needed. Activity without rest. Imagine that you would have incessant activity, complete day, which is unending. Activity would exhaust you and kill you. Or only rest without activity would mean that everything, all your faculties would atrophy and then you would decay then and there. So the contrast is absolutely necessary, and the whole universe is founded, built on these contrasts, positive and negative, the polarities. Similarly, good and evil, pain and pleasure. It is pain, explain, which throws light on what is pleasure. It is the experience of sorrow which gives a certain status, certain value for the experience of happiness. If there were to be only happiness, it would lose its value. Because there is no contrast due to which it obtains certain value, certain weightage. Right? So this is very nicely explained by HPB in The Secret Doctrine. I'll just read this one section. One cannot claim God as the synthesis of the whole universe, as omnipresent and omniscient and infinite, and then divorce him from evil. And then divorce him from evil. As there is far more evil than good, none of us can deny, right? As there is far more evil than good in the world, it follows on logical grounds that either God must include evil or stand as the direct cause of it, or else surrender his claims to absoluteness. The ancients understood this so well that their philosophers defined evil as the lining of God or good. Demon est Deus inversus being an old adage. Demon is the inverse of God. Or DT or good is the inverse of evil. Demon est Deus inversus. Indeed, evil is but an antagonizing blind force in nature. It is reaction, opposition and contrast. Evil for some, good for others. There is no malum in se. That is, inherently something is evil. There is nothing like that. Only the shadow of light, without which light could have no existence even in our perceptions. If evil disappeared, good would disappear along with it from earth. Everywhere the speculations of Kabbalists treat of evil as a force which is antagonistic but at the same time essential to good, as giving it vitality and existence which it could never have otherwise. Very philosophical perspective about good and evil. And this is again beautifully, expressed by Marcus Aurelius, who says let me serve every day when I get in the morning, get up in the morning, that today I will meet such and such a bad person, such and such a evil person, such a treacherous person. I'm sure I will meet one or the other evil person today. But then I share a certain kinship with him. What is the kinship? Not the kinship of the blood or seed, but the kinship of the same mind, the kinship of the same divine fragment, which is shared amongst all of us. So that way, he and me are brothers. I cannot separate myself from the evil man because we originate from the same source. And instead of me seeing him as something opposite to my nature, let me see that person as something complementary to my nature. He says, just like there are pairs of hands, would you call the left hand as something opposite to the right hand as something opposing or as something complementary? Would you call the upper row of the teeth something opposite to the lower row of the teeth, or would you call it something as complementary to each other? He says, this is the perspective that I need to have towards the evil that I see in others. But even after knowing all this, that demon as juice inverses, contrast of good and evil is absolutely necessary for universe to exist. Without contrast, universe would not exist. If we contemplate on it, it becomes plainly evident. But still the question lingers in our mind, why should there be evil in my life? Just imagine a world or one's life of only good things happening. It will be so enjoyable, at least to begin with, right? So the question still remains in our mind, why should there be pain? Why should there be evil in my life? This metaphysical understanding is okay. But why pain in my life? Why should there be sorrow? Why should there be evil, right? The answer that is given can be summed up in one sentence, that pain has a purpose. And the purpose is that it awakens your soul and points it in the right direction. The basic idea is that we are all souls who are here in this body for a certain grand purpose. And the moment we forget that purpose, the moment we deviate from that purpose, we are deviating from the harmony, from the basic direction in which nature moves. And that brings pain to us. And what is this? Sufis have a very nice way of expressing this. They say, your body is actually the tomb. You have made it a pleasure ground, but it is actually a tomb in reality, wherein your divine conscience is buried, crucified every day. And were it not for the purpose, the divine help brought by pain to awaken your soul, you would get mingled with the body and enjoy and then never progress at all. So they say pain has a great purpose. It comes to awaken the soul from its tomb and show that you have a great purpose here. So pain serves that purpose, where it is used as a knife, as a medicine, as a poison, as the gates of the gold say. So the example that what we can have in our normal day-to-day experience is that the pain serves is when there is a cut on the body. Assume it is unpleasant when there is a cut. It is painful, right? But were it not for that, you would not attend to it. While walking, there is a stone, I trip, and then there is a bleeding that happens. Were it not for the pain, I wouldn't attend to it. And without me attending to it, I can as well bleed to death. So pain comes as a reminder. This is what the Sankhya philosophy say, that the three kinds of pain incessantly torment man. the pertinacity that we were speaking of in the morning, right? Incessantly they torment man. Now, the tendency of the man first is to the first reaction is to seek for a solution to this sorrow, this pain inside himself, in some external arrangement, whether it's insurance or this, that or other thing. Any such external changes that we do, saying that with these changes in external situations, things, then I will avoid pain. This may be even things like your rituals, the ceremonies that you do to ward off evil. But the Sankhya philosophy says that, yeah, he does it, but then there are two problems with it. One is that, firstly, there is no guarantee of solution to this problem. Anything that you do externally, there is no guarantee that it will solve your problem completely. And second problem is, assuming it solves, that solution will not be permanent. So, he says that due to this constant torment of the pain to the soul, finally the soul begins to ask questions about what is the cause of pain, what is the root of pain, what is the source of evil in human life. Then he becomes a jignasu and through that acquires spiritual knowledge, which is the end of all evil. So, actually pain has a great purpose. In the evolution of the soul, it has a great purpose. Next is, you imagine all your desires have been fulfilled. The best condition that you want, the situation that you want, the things that you need, the fame, the glory or anything, power that you need, assume that it has been given to you. If you put yourself in that position and then think about it, you will find that there is still some discontent. There is something missing. There will still be something missing. Some void inside us which is not filled. The best circumstances, anything that you ask is given to you, but still there is something missing. That's the feeling that we will get. It's called as the divine discontent. Also, you will find that there is a kind of natural pessimism. Pessimism in its natural sense, not carried to its extreme negativity. The pessimism which says that there is evil everywhere and due to one or the other thing, all these good things that I have acquired for myself, I will have to let go or it will be snatched from me. Now this natural pessimism in life, it comes from the intuitive understanding of the soul, which has, we have gone through innumerable passes, and that experience is there in us. Intuitive understanding, it speaks to us and says that you cannot find permanent happiness here. Everything around you is impermanent. And you are trying to find something permanent in things which are inherently impermanent. How is it possible? So that's that intuitive understanding that we have through such disappointments, sorrows and pains. How many times we have gone through this in the past life? Buddha says, if you collect all the teardrops that you have shed in your past lives, it becomes an ocean. So many times we have cried and felt disappointed over the same things. So that experience is very strong in us, which that natural pessimism. This is very, very nicely explained by HPB in the article, The Origin of Evil. She says, pessimism, that crown of lurking evil everywhere. It is thus of twofold nature and bring fruits of two kinds. It is a natural characteristic in physical man and becomes a curse only to the ignorant. For the ignorant, the pessimism becomes something unbearable. And some people take the extreme step of trying to end one's own life thinking that by giving up this physical envelope, they have overcome the source of sorrow and evil, which is ignorance, right? So it is natural characteristic in physical man and becomes a curse only to the ignorant. It is a boon to the spiritual, inasmuch as it makes the latter turn into the right path and bring him to the discovery of another as fundamental truth, namely that all in this world is only preparatory because transitory. It is like a chink in the dark prison walls of earth life, through which breaks in a ray of light from the eternal home, which, illuminating the inner senses, whispers to the prisoner in his shell of clay of the origin and the dual mystery of our being. So this is the purpose of that natural pessimism. But then, let us again ask the question, what is the fundamental source of evil? It is said that at one level, any conditioned existence is evil. Your fundamental true nature is unconditioned, free. Therefore, any conditioned existence, whether in this earth life or any of the higher celestial realms, where there is far more freedom and joy and happiness compared to the fragments of bits and pieces of joy and happiness we have in this life, those higher realms of being will be far more happier, peace and contentment. But still, even that is a source of sorrow, which is why Shankaracharya says, even in the Anandamaya Kosha, which is the one just before that of Atman, even there is a possibility of you falling back into the deepest error, because anything conditioned is in that sense the root of evil. So it is said, when homogeneity becomes heterogeneity, there begins evil. When the one becomes many, is evil. You know, at a metaphysical level, when the one spirit reflects itself as many, when differentiation happens, the source of evil. But this is a necessary evil. Nevertheless, conditioned existence is evil in one sense. But it is necessary. Without this necessary evil, the soul wouldn't progress at all. This is again in the same article explained very nicely. Eastern wisdom teaches that spirit has to pass through the ordeal of incarnation and life. That is the condition of each one of us. We are portion of spirit, and by the law of necessity, we are going through this world of conditioned existence, inherently unconditioned. So very nature of soul is to be free, but it takes on this conditioned existence for a purpose. Eastern wisdom teaches that spirit has to pass through the ordeal of incarnation and life and be baptized with matter before it can reach experience and knowledge, after which only it receives the baptism of soul or self-consciousness and may return to its original condition of God plus experience, ending with omniscience. It is God, but there is experience that is lacking. It is inherently pure. We are inherently divine, but the divinity has to be acquired. The seed is inherently the tree, but it has to go deep into the soil, into the darkness, and then from there sprout, grow its roots, sprout, come out, weather all the changes around it, gain strength, become a tree which can bear fruit. Right? In other words, it can return to the original state of homogeneity of primordial essence only through the addition of the fruitage of karma. which alone is able to create an absolute conscious deity, removed but one degree from the absolute all. So this is why the soul is in Zohar. There is a beautiful story where the soul is made to plead before the deity that, oh deity, I am very happy in this world, in the celestial world, in its own realm. I don't want to go to that world where I will be exposed to all kinds of evil, contaminated with different kinds of substances. I don't want to do that. But then comes the decree of the eternal law, which says that you have to. Is very nicely given here in Key to Theosophy, that the soul is made to plead her freedom before the God. Lord of the universe, I am happy in this world and do not wish to go into another world where I shall be a handmaid of desire, and be exposed to all kinds of pollutions. And the teacher says, the doctrine of fatal necessity, the everlasting immutable law, is asserted in the answer of the deity. Against thy will, thou shalt becomest an embryo, and against thy will, thou art born. Why? Light would be incomprehensible without darkness, to make it manifest by contrast. Good would be no longer good without evil, to show the priceless nature of the boon. And so personal virtue could claim no merit unless it has passed through the furnace of temptation. Inherent divinity is not acquired divinity. So it has to pass through the world of matter, through temptations, and acquire divinity, the fruitage of karma. So that is that's the journey in which we are all in. But this is one kind of, we may say, evil, necessary evil, right? Conditioned existence, necessary for the soul to progress. But there is another kind of evil, and this is, the source of this evil is man himself. It's a man-made evil. Nature did not intend so much of evil to be there, but man, through his ignorance, creates such causes which will bring about such evil and sorrow. He is the source of evil in another's life because he is selfish, he is self-centered, and for the fulfillment of his desires, he sets up causes in motion which will bring about sorrow to others. He becomes the source of evil in others' lives. And where does this evil come from? So much war, crime, violence, exploitation. All this comes from man and from a particular aspect of man. See, just like we see the contrast in nature, light and darkness, right? Similarly, analogous to that is the two selves in man. The mystery of dual being that we were studying. There are two selves in man. One is his true, immortal, divine aspect, and another is that divine aspect reflected or conditioned or cramped in desires, in matter, in this body. It is actually one, but in the course of evolution, there are two aspects of that. So it is from this lower, temporary, transient, ignorant aspect of us that comes all, that is a Pandora's box, which when opened creates havoc, wreaks havoc. So man's true nature is not evil, like we were discussing yesterday. He is inherently good. Evil is an aberration. And through that also, he is learning lessons, as we will see. There is a wonderful teachings given on good and evil in the letters that have helped me. So this evil, again, to go back to print, a very small portion. In human life, evil denotes only the polarity of matter and spirit. A struggle for life between the two manifested principles in space and time, which principles are one per se, inasmuch as they are rooted in absolute. So in human life, this contrast, this polarity, and the fight for existence between the two selves, the self of spirit, the self of matter, the noble, unselfish, universal aspect of oneself, and the ignorant, selfish, self-centered aspect in us. And man's destiny is weaved by these two forces. What do we listen to? There are two voices in us. The voice of the pleasure and desires, and the voice of what is right and wrong, conscience. Based on what we listen to, depends upon our destiny. So the teachers say, the more you listen to your divine nature, your prototype in heaven, quote unquote, your spiritual prototype, the more you are, your life is in harmony with that universal nature, the less dangerous will be your physical conditions. You cannot bring about happiness and security to yourself through rearrangement of physical things and conditions and situations. True security comes from following what is called as dharma. This was very well understood among the ancients. You have the story of Yudhishthira. Many instances, but, one significant one is, you all know about the questions that Yaksha asks, and how none of the four Pandavas care to answer Yaksha, so they are instantly killed. And then Yudhishthira comes, he answers everything perfectly because he is dharma itself. Then Yaksha gives him a boon: you can resurrect one of your brothers, choose anyone. Then Yudhishthira chooses, I think, either Nakula or Sahadeva, either of the two, but the sons of Madri Devi, not Kunti, not his own blood brothers. Then Yaksha asks him, see, you can choose Bhima, whose strength is like 18 elephants or so. He will be your protection in this forest. Or you can choose Gandivi, Arjuna, whose power is unmatched by anyone. He will be your protection. Why are you choosing Nakula or Sahadeva? Then he goes on to explain that the true protection of man is not in anything external, but in following the law of dharma. The law of dharma dictates that Kunti's one son is alive, which is me. Madri Devi's two sons are dead. She needs the pleasure of having one son at least being alive. And my duty as being promised to Madri Devi to protect her sons, it is my duty to resurrect them. So this comes out beautifully well, that it is nothing external, it is your following of your spiritual nature and understanding it and living one's lat lines, which is the true security. This is what His Holiness the Dalai Lama says in a very humorous way. He calls it enlightened self-interest. Enlightened self-interest. This is the understanding that my good is inextricably interwoven with the good of all beings. So, if I am thinking that I can secure good to myself and avoid evil at the cost of others, at the expense of others, or by neglecting the good of others, it is impossible for me to achieve it. Because I am inextricably interwoven with others, their good is my good, their what affects them as evil is my evil, so it becomes my responsibility to ensure their good. The Jains also understand this very well. In a few days time they are celebrating this festival Michami Dukkadam, right? You go and read that prayer which they say during this idea of interconnectedness of beings and how non-violence of one person will affect for good so many beings around him, that interconnectedness is very well understood among the Jains. So, what is it that we call evil in our life? We can take a few examples. When some disease strikes us, we think that is evil, right? Or when some disappointment happens, we wanted something, whether it is promotion or take anything. We wanted something but we didn't get it, then we think that is evil. Or thirdly, somebody injures us, harms us, we think that is evil. But just let us look at these three things. Take disappointment. If you understand your life and the circumstances of your life from the perspective of the law of karma, what does it mean? It means that whatever is yours, whatever belongs to you, it will come to you. And no power in the universe can stop it from reaching you, whether that thing or situation is good or bad. What belongs to you will come and reach you. So if something, after your efforts, something you have not been able to gain something, obtain something, then it does not belong to you. And still trying to snatch it from someone else through unfair means, we create causes which will bring about our own sorrow. So if we understand the law of karma, then a certain equal-mindedness comes among the events of life. The fortunes and misfortunes is seen with a certain equanimity. Take disease. What is disease? Some internal disharmony, disturbance that has been generated in the past, stored on your inner plane, is working itself out. It is flowing out through your body and producing certain effects. That is disease. Now why are you crying over it? Why do you want to stop it and hold on to that negativity? In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad probably, right? The verse comes, Vyadihi paramam tapas, or something like that. Paramo tapaha, yeah. Which means that disease is a great tapas, austerity. So when we take this perspective, then disease or disappointment does not affect us. Because we are taking not the perspective of the personality, the temporary personality, but you are thinking and acting as an eternal soul. Take injury from others. Can there be any effect without a cause? And if enmity and harm that is coming to me is the effect, it certainly means that there must be causes which have been and I must have been responsible in it. So accept it. There is negativity that you have generated in the past, ill will, hatred. It is working itself out. You have harmed the person, whether on the plane of mind, speech or body. It's coming back to you. Accept it, return good. This was one of the duties which was given in the book of Manu. Each man's duty is to render good for evil. Again, it is based on this understanding of the law of life, that the situation in which you are in has been created by you, caused by you, and the enmity that you are seeing, which you see from others, is your own. You and him or her have worked together to bring about this, and if you retaliate, if you render evil for evil, eye for a tooth, then you are adding fuel to fire instead of adding water and then extinguishing it and making that person who is your enemy, converting him into a friend. So return good for evil and you will see that evil in your life gradually becomes less and less, because you are not adding more and more, you are not complicating the matter. You are then and there closing the account, not depositing more into it. So this is very well explained in this small section in the letters that have helped me. Please read page 22 to 26, 27 onwards. Excellent discourse, very meditative on good and evil. It, when you contemplate and understand this, it changes your perspective. The way you see things in life, people, it changes your perspective. I'll just read one small section of that. How shall we say that any state is evil in an absolute sense? Can we say, in its ultimate analysis, can we say anything is evil at all? Take murder, right? We were discussing about murder yesterday. Take murder. It seems evil. It seems an evil, right? True, we cannot really take life, but we can destroy. But we can destroy a vehicle of the divine principle of life and impede the course of a soul using that vehicle. You cannot kill the soul. Nevertheless, by destroying the body, you have impeded the evolution of that particular soul, right? You have done that. You have committed murder, right? But we are more injured by the deed than any other. The person who is murdered is facing less evil than the person who has committed. This is what Socrates always said, that it is always a greater good to bear injustice than to do the smallest act of injustice. It is better to bear evil than to commit the least amount of evil. Look at what happens when a person commits such a crime. How the law of karma, which is both justice and mercy, how does this work out to bring about the evolution of the soul? To help the soul which is caught up in this delusion, in this diseased state, how through rendering of justice, it has brought about its merciful aspect. Right? Look at this. The deed sends us to hell, as it were, for one or more incarnations, to a condition of misery. The natural retribution of our own resultant karma, both the penalties imposed by man and that exacted by occult law, chasten and soften the soul. It has passed through a most solemn experience which has become necessary to its growth and which in the end is the cause of its additional purification. From the black smoke of human life, winged flames arise, as the voice of silence was. Flames purified, neath the eye of the karma, neath the eye of karmic retribution. This is the thing. Anything that we call evil has its, in itself, it has the power of bringing out good. So in yin and yang, there is a black aspect, but there is a dot of white in it. Probably it refers to this, The transformation effect, the transformational aspect of anything that we call as evil, bad, it was a necessary consequence of the limitations of matter. For had the soul remained celestial and in free being, it would not have committed murder. Nor has the immortal soul, the spectator, any share in the wrong. It is only the personality, the elementary part of the soul, which has sinned. So it is the elementary part of the soul. Yesterday we were talking of, should we condemn a man who has committed such a crime and only respect a man who is on the path towards spirit, right? So what is it that has committed the sin? It is the elementary ignorant aspect of man, not his permanent true aspect, which is good, inherently good. So when we look at these and analyze the various things that we call as evil, we actually find that evil is actually not evil at all. What we call as evil is actually an opportunity from the higher aspect. So we need to understand the law of karma, reincarnation, and the soul's progress through these laws. Then life becomes far more cheerful, optimistic, far more joy in life when we have this higher perspective. We find depression and negativity and sorrow because our eyes are riveted to the earth, which means our eyes are riveted to our personality, to our transitory aspect. You read this, how do we make our life more full of, how do we make our life full of light, happiness? We can do that in the midst of all the sorrow that we see, when we change our perspective and take a higher stand, then we can bring about, then life becomes far bearable. You see this, and read this small section, how we can make life full of optimism, right? As mankind multiplies, and with it suffering, which is a natural result of an increased number of units that generate it, each unit generates sorrow, right? So mankind, there is more people, there is more sorrow because more units are generating causes for sorrow, right? As mankind multiplies and with it suffering, which is the natural result of an increasing number of units that generate it, sorrow and pain are intensified. We live in an atmosphere of gloom and despair, but this is because our eyes are downcast and riveted to the earth, with all its physical and grossly material manifestations. If that man proceeding on his life journey looked not heavenwards, which is but a figure of speech, but within himself, and centered his point of observation on the inner man, he would soon escape from the coils of the great serpent of illusion. From the cradle to the grave, his life would then be supportable and worth living even in its worst phases. So with this understanding, with this perspective, knowledge, life becomes bearable, meaningful, profoundly meaningful. There's far more happiness and joy. Marcus Aurelius says the same thing. He says, let's say you have your mother as well as a stepmother. You have your duties towards your stepmother also, not only towards your own mother, right? You don't neglect the duties towards your stepmother. You go do all the things necessary for her. But when you need comfort and solace and peace, you don't go to your stepmother, you go to your mother. Similarly, he says to himself that you have your kingdom to take care, the court, which is your stepmother. And you have the philosophy, which is your own mother, true mother. Now, you take care of all the things that you have to do, all the duties that you have to do as a king, as an emperor, you do all that. But for peace, solace, you go back to philosophy. Beautifully explained, very nicely written, I'll just read this. If you had a stepmother and a mother at the same time, you would pay attention to your stepmother, but nevertheless, your constant recourse would be to your mother. This is now how it is with the court and the philosophy. So return to philosophy again and again and take your comfort in her. She will make the other life seem bearable to you and you bearable in it. So the importance of acquiring this soul wisdom, without which this natural pessimism that is there becomes more and more negative, and life becomes unbearable. First of all, you are in darkness. On top of it, you are creating more causes for darkness. It will envelop you and everybody around you in more and more darkness and sorrow and misery. So take the true philosophy of life. That is the work of evolution of the soul, is what they are concerned with. This is the true theosophical movement, evolution of the soul, all souls. So when you take this knowledge and see how important it is, and look at the sorrow and evil around you, if we can call evil anything after having all this discussion, then arises a certain desire. We'll have to stop here. And that desire is the desire to make this knowledge available to others. That is the true theosophical movement. So, nearing the end of time, but we can take up any questions or any points, comments that you may have.